When, after 10 or 15 minutes, everything was cleared away and everyone was seated again, B said, "In light of what we've heard here tonight, I've decided to alter my plans for the next few weeks." Except for Sheeran, who reacted to his words as blandly as if she'd spoken them herself, his listeners were clearly astonished. "Everyone here has been with me through at least one full series of lectures. This means you know what Jared doesn't know. You know why there are pickets out there denouncing me as the devil's spawn, Beelzebub the beast, and indeed the Antichrist himself."
"They picket because they do not understand."
"What do you think, Sheeran?"
"They picket because they do understand."
"I'm afraid Sheeran is right, Frau Hartmann. But that's beside the point. Father Lofra and probably others of his rank have made themselves our judges, and these men won't be polling the masses for their views. Don't you agree?" This question was for me, and I told him he was absolutely right. Heinz Teitel raised his hand. This awkward young man, along with his wife Monica, seemed the least at home of anyone in this oddly assorted group. With apologies for wasting time with a question the others probably didn't need answered, he asked if I would briefly explain the term under discussion.
"For us, the Antichrist seems more a symbolic person than a real one, like Mammon or Pandora."
"That's not at all an easy question," I told him, "but I'll do my best. The Antichrist is a central figure in the mythological history of the cosmos, as it was widely understood in ancient times. In our culture, as B would say. The culture of the Great Forgetting perceived the universe and humankind to be the products of a single creative effort that had occurred just a few thousand years ago. It perceived the events of human history to be the central events of the universe itself, unfolding over a fairly brief period of time. Only a couple hundred generations of humans had lived from the beginning of time, and it was imagined that only a couple hundred more would live before the end of time, and perhaps even less than that. It's important to realize that people had no conception of a universe billions of years old, and with more billions of years ahead of it. As they imagined it, the cosmic drama was only a few thousand years old, and was not far from being over. The central issue of this cosmic drama was a struggle between good and evil being waged on this planet. Among the Jews, who were probably the most potent religious mythologists of the age, the issue would be settled by two champions. God's champion, the Messiah, was expected momentarily, and his appearance would mark the beginning of the final days. An adversary would also appear, Satan's champion, a man of sin. The two champions would battle, the forces of evil would be vanquished, and history and the universe would come to an end. Early Christian authors had the same vision of history, but for them, of course, the Messiah had already come, and all that remained was for the man of sin to come. Now that the Messiah had been named as the Christ, his adversary could be named as the Antichrist. Now that the Messiah's mission was plain, his adversary's mission was plain. Since Christ came to lead all humanity to God, Antichrist will come to lead all humanity to Satan. And Antichrist will not fail, any more than Christ failed. Antichrist will be loved and followed as fervently as Christ. But only for a time, of course. Ultimately, after a cataclysmic battle, the forces of God will triumph, bringing history to its conclusion. This clear vision of the Antichrist became muddled and trivialized in succeeding centuries, as one generation after another found someone to lambast with the name. Anyone widely feared or hated could expect to be called the Antichrist, and eventually both sides of the Reformation had to bear the label. After this period, from the 17th century on, people were sick of the whole idea. Every generation continues to nominate a candidate of its own, Napoleon or Hitler or Saddam Hussein, but no one takes it very seriously. A restless silence greeted this summary. Everyone seemed to wander off mentally for about a minute and a half. Then Heinz was ready to go on.
"I can understand why no one takes it seriously," he said. "What I cannot understand is why you take it seriously. You and your order and your Father Lufra."
I admitted it was a good question.
It might help, I said, to understand the situation the way the early Christian theologian Origen did. He said, in effect, that every generation will produce forerunners and prefigurements of the Antichrist, and these will deserve the name insofar as they embody the spirit of the Antichrist. It's from among this number that at last one will come who deserves the name in its proper sense. It is for this one that we maintain our vigilance.
What does that mean, one who deserves the name in his proper sense?
This is precisely what can't be known in advance. It can only be known in the event itself. That is, when we see the real Antichrist, then we'll know what the name means. Then we'll say to ourselves, how could we have imagined Nero was the Antichrist, or the Pope, or Luther, or Hitler? The real Antichrist will reveal to us the meaning of the prophecy itself. Indeed, that's how we'll know him. He'll be the one who shows us what it means to be the Antichrist. The silence that followed this speech was a deadly one. At last, young Albrecht broke his silence to ask B why he would change his plans for my sake. I was surprised when he spoke not with a German accent, but with an English one.
To get rid of him the sooner, B said simply.
If you want to get rid of him, let us do it. Heinz and Michael and me. We could take him out and dump him in the lake or something.
I doubt if that'd help. What do you think, Jared?
I agree. It wouldn't help. I'm infinitely replaceable. And if I went missing, suspicion would fall on you immediately.
I'm afraid Jared's right.
I still don't see what's to be gained by helping him.
Show me how hindering him will gain more, and I'll hinder him. Albrecht gave it some serious thought, but couldn't come up with anything.
B stood up and said, I think we'll stop here. Sheeran or I will be in touch with you.
Then, turning to me,
Sheeran will walk you to your hotel. Come back tomorrow at 6 or 7.
I was surprised to find it was still dark night when we emerged from the theater. Although I could see the time on my wrist, I had the feeling dawn should be well advanced. We walked in silence for a few moments. Then I remarked that they seemed very much at home at the theater.
The director of the board is a supporter.
You actually live there, then?
It's our home base, yes.
But why Radina? As soon as I said it, I remembered that I knew why. The mysterious caller had explained it to me over the phone in Munich. For a second, I was in an icy panic. Then I realized it was a perfectly natural question. She said,
there's a medical center here devoted to the study and treatment of mixed connective tissue diseases.
B has a mixed connective tissue disease?
I have a mixed connective tissue disease. Scleroderma, in fact.
I'm sorry. My medical education is pretty spotty. Is that connected to this? I waved a finger over my nose and cheeks.
The lupus butterfly.
Lupus? I'm sorry, what's lupus?
Another mixed connective tissue disease. I have symptoms of both.
I hope it's not serious.
Do you?
Yes, I do. Believe it or not, priests are occasionally capable of normal human feelings.
It all depends on how involved other organs are. Heart, lungs, kidneys. Unfortunately, in my case, it's very serious indeed. No one expects me to see the new century. On the bright side, in my case, the end will probably come suddenly, and I should be quite active until then. It's not a pretty disease to linger with.
Clergy are trained to have plenty of good, solid things to say at moments like this, but I didn't reach for any of them. I didn't even want to say for the third or fourth time that I was sorry. We walked on for a bit in silence. Finally, she asked if I knew why B had told her to walk me home. I said I didn't.
He didn't say so, but I'm sure he wants me to ask you this unthinkable question. What will your father, Lulfred, do if he decides that B is the Antichrist?
Yes, that is an unthinkable question.
It would be unthinkable for Father Lulfred to decide that B is the Antichrist?
Yes.
Then why send you here?
It took me a minute to work that out, incredible as it may seem. Finally, I said,
if a stain that looks like a weeping Madonna one day appears on Mr. Smith's living room wall,
and everyone swears they see tears flowing down her face every Friday at 3 o'clock, and thousands of pilgrims are streaming past day and night, week after week, and people are claiming that the sick are being miraculously healed at this shrine, then eventually somebody from the church is going to be sent to look into it. This will be some unlucky priest like me, sent from afar, because it would be too painful for the local priest to point out to his neighbors that this stain appeared right after that big rainstorm last spring, and the Smiths had had in a local handyman to fix their leaky roof the same week, and no one is allowed to get near the Madonna on Friday afternoons but Mr. Smith, and the vial he uses to collect the teardrops could just as easily be used to put the teardrops in place. And even though Mr. Smith doesn't actually charge anyone to go through his house, there's a bushel basket by the door, and it's always full of money. And though one or two have claimed to be healed of something, they never stick around long enough to be checked by any doctor. So this priest isn't sent to see if there's been a miracle. He's sent to make sure there hasn't been a miracle. But if everyone assumes there was no miracle, why send a priest? Well, because someone has to be sent. No matter how unlikely, no matter how improbable, someone has to be sent. And someone has to read his report. Absolutely. It will be read, scrutinized, confirmed, notarized, and sworn to, and eventually copies of it will find their way into diocesan files, and probably even Vatican files, where they'll sit until the end of time. We walked on through the deserted streets of Ratina. As my hotel came into view, I felt one last question brewing in Sheeran. I'm not quite sure how to ask this. Did you come here thinking of B as a stain on the wall? No, not at all. When you're sent, you have to take the investigation seriously. Even though the conclusion is foregone? Virtually foregone. 99.99% foregone. There's always the remote possibility, almost infinitely remote, but there all the same, that the stain is a miraculous apparition that weeps real tears every Friday afternoon. Or that B is the Antichrist. That's right. Then the question still needs to be answered. What would Father Lulfer do if he decided that B is the Antichrist? He would tell his superiors to prepare for a new era in human history. He wouldn't care to do that. No, he certainly wouldn't. We paused under the hotel marquee, and I turned to face her. Her eyes came up to meet mine with a look of vulnerable entreaty that sank into my heart like a knife. She held my gaze for half a second, then glanced away. I want to believe you are telling me the truth. I am, adding to myself, at least about this much. Monday, May 20, Ratina. 6 o'clock, nearly time to head for the theater. Father Lulfer has received his daily fax in continued silence. I've performed routine maintenance chores and have brought this diary up to the minute. I've also acquired a very expensive tape recorder that, set at a slow tape speed, will put 2 full hours of sound on each side of a single cassette without my having to fool with it. B was alone in the subterranean green room of the Schauspielhaus Wanfried, and as I wound my way through the jumbled acres of theatrical antiques, he watched me with a rather sad smile. I showed him the tape recorder I'd bought and asked if he minded my taping our conversations.
It'd be pointless to mind. The purpose of our conversation is to make a record for your Father Lulfra.
True.
At this point, you should know that I have nothing as orderly as a curriculum for you. I'm constructing a mosaic, and the pieces of a mosaic can be added in any order. In the early stages, there's nothing like an image, but as pieces are added, an image begins to emerge. As still more pieces are added, the image becomes more distinct, more definite, so that eventually you feel sure that the basic picture is before you. From this point on, the picture can only gain in sharpness and detail, as pieces continue to be added, until at last it seems that there are no missing pieces at all.
I understand.
Here's a piece to begin with. You remember young Heinz and Monica Teitel, who were here last night?
I remember them.
They followed me through a complete course of lectures, and so have heard at least once everything I'm able to say in public that I feel will be comprehensible. But if an outsider asks them something that goes beyond anything they've heard from me, they must refer the question to me. They know what I'm saying, but my message is not sufficiently theirs that they can generate answers of their own. For them, the mosaic is only a rough sketch. Frau Dr. Hartmann has twice followed me through my course of lectures and has attended many more such soirees as we engaged in here last night. If an outsider asks her a question that goes beyond anything she's heard from me, she may try to deal with it. But when she reports her answer to me, she usually finds out that my answer would have been quite different from hers, sometimes even contradictory to hers. She, too, knows what I'm saying, but my message is not sufficiently hers that she can generate answers with certainty. She can see the general outlines clearly enough, but the image in the mosaic is still rather shadowy. Michael, on the other hand, has been with me a bit longer than Frau Hartmann, and if an outsider asks him a question beyond anything he's heard from me, he almost never gets the answer wrong, though it will probably lack the depth and assurance that it would have if it came from me. The message is almost his, and the image in the mosaic is substantially complete, though still a bit vague, almost as if it were not quite in perfect focus yet. But Sheeran has been with me longer than anyone, and if an outsider asks a question that goes beyond anything she's heard from me, she'll answer without hesitation. Her answer will not necessarily have the same emphasis as mine would have, or be delivered in the same style, or reflect an identical point of view, but it will have the same authenticity and power, because the mosaic image she's referring to for her answer is as solid and well-focused as mine is. The message is hers entirely. It's as much hers as it is mine. She is the message, in the same sense that I am the message. B paused as if for a response, and I told him that I understood what he was saying, but wasn't sure why he was saying it. I'm giving you a second look at something I talked about at our first meeting. When Jesus departed, he left no one behind who was the message. I managed to suppress an urge to blurt out a wow. But wow was certainly what sprang to mind. This was undeniably true, not in any sense a condemnation, but undeniably true. Jesus had left behind no one who could speak with his authority, no one who could say, this is what's what. There were very elementary questions the apostles couldn't answer with confidence. Like, to what degree were those of the new dispensation bound by the laws of the old dispensation? You can hardly get more fundamental than that. In fact, it was St. Paul, a man who had never even seen Jesus, who ended up saying, this is what's what, with more authority than anyone else could muster. More than John, or Peter, or James, as far as we know. Paul was the message. But even with the writings of Paul and all the evangelists, it still took 300 years of Christian thought to reconstitute Christ's message, to piece together the hints, reconcile apparent contradictions, cut away heresies and lunacies and irrelevancies, and organize it into a self-consistent, coherent creed that more or less everyone could agree on. Even so, I told B that I still didn't quite know what he was getting at. Last night I talked about changing minds. I said that if the world is saved, it will be saved by people with changed minds, not by programs, by people with changed minds.
I remember.
What you're here for today is to have your mind changed.
I looked at him blankly.
Right now, Jared, what message are you?
I don't follow you.
When Jesus departed, he left no one behind who was the message. None of the apostles was his message. You understand what I mean by that, don't you?
Yes.
But you're not in the same condition as those apostles, are you? Christ's message is yours, isn't it? If I ask you whether
premarital sex is right or wrong, you won't have to call Father Lulfra to find out the answer, will you? If I ask you whether suicide is right or wrong, you won't have to consult the scriptures, will you?
No.
You possess these answers as your own. These and 10,000 others like them.
That's right.
Then I'll ask again. What message are you?
I'm Christ's message.
A Lutheran minister would say the same, as would a Presbyterian minister or a Baptist preacher, even though some of their answers would differ from your own. So, here you are, and I want you to understand what you're doing here.
Yes, I see.
Though he probably wouldn't think of it in these terms. Father Lulfra has sent you here to become my message.
An icy chill skittered down my spine.
If you press a group of school children to explain why we're teetering on the edge of calamity, they'll soon trot out all the coffee house cliches. All the theories the Unabomber set forth so solemnly and at such great length in his magnum opus a couple years ago. Out of control technological advancement, out of control industrial greed, out of control government expansion, and so on. What is typical of all these coffeehouse explanations is that their intellectual horizon is too close. They're looking for causes too near to the effect. This is the overriding result of the Great Forgetting. In our culture, East and West, twins of a single birth, human history is only what's happened since our agricultural revolution began. In our culture, because of the Great Forgetting, people looking at the horizon are only looking back in time a few thousand years. In 1654, Archbishop Usher calculated that the human race was born in 4004 B.C., Later, archaeologists calculated that this is just when the very first cities of Mesopotamia began to be built. For a people who imagined that man was born an agriculturalist and a civilization builder, what could make better sense? The human race appeared in Mesopotamia 6,000 years ago and immediately began building cities. The Great Forgetting imprinted this picture indelibly on our cultural mind. It doesn't matter that everyone knows the human race is 3 million years older than the cities of Mesopotamia. Every molecule of thought in our culture bears the impress of the idea that we needn't look beyond the Mesopotamian horizon in order to understand our history.
And you're telling me that your horizon is 3 million years.
Always. For me, Mesopotamia is erased as a horizon. How do you think one manages such a thing?
I suppose one manages it by climbing a ladder, which is to say, by seeing things from a higher vantage point.
That's right. When you do that, events that formerly seemed huge, because they're close, take their place in a deeper landscape and no longer stand out with the same prominence as before. B paused for a moment as though searching for his bearings. We were talking about the clichés that people trot out to explain why we're teetering on the edge of calamity. Out-of-control technological advancement, out-of-control industrial greed, out-of-control government expansion, and so on. These are explanations that make sense to people of the Great Forgetting, to people who think that they're seeing the human horizon when they look at the Mesopotamian horizon. For people of the Great Forgetting, our agricultural revolution was literally the beginning of human history. When I view the human horizon, I'm looking back 3 million years past the Mesopotamian horizon. So it's simply grotesque to think of our agricultural revolution as signaling the beginning of human history. It signals something, to be sure, but not remotely the beginning of human history.
What does it signal, then?
It signals the occurrence of a mind change, a new vision of the world and our place in it.
How do you conclude that a mind change occurred?
I concluded from the fact that a revolution occurred. Revolutions don't occur among people who are thinking in the same old way. You don't find an agricultural revolution occurring among people who are just hungry, for example.
Why is that?
Because starving people don't plant crops any more than drowning people build life rafts.
The only people who can afford to wait for crops to grow are people who already have food, plenty of food.
Yes, that makes sense.
In the same way, most people imagine that agriculture was an inevitable development because it makes life so much easier and more secure. In fact, it makes life more toilsome and less secure. Every study of calories spent versus calories gained confirms that the more your food comes from agriculture, the harder you have to work for it. The first Neolithic farmers, who probably only planted a few crops and depended largely on foraging, worked much harder to stay alive than their Mesolithic ancestors. Later farmers, who planted more crops and did less foraging, worked even harder to stay alive. And completely modern totalitarian farmers, who depend entirely on crops, work harder to stay alive than anyone else. And famine, far from being banished by agriculture, is actually a byproduct of agriculture, and is never found apart from it. Travel to the most inhospitable desert of Australia during the most horrendous drought, and you won't find a single starving Aborigine anywhere.
Okay, I guess I see what you're doing. You're answering all the objections before they're raised.
All the objections to what?
To your thesis, which is that our agricultural revolution signaled the appearance of a mind change. It wasn't just starving people trying something new out of desperation. It wasn't just people looking for an easier life. It wasn't just people looking for more security.
That's right. Far from having an easier life or increasing their security, they actually worked harder and were less secure than their hunting-gathering ancestors. So there's no question here of people doing something just because it was more comfortable.
It seemed to me that B was in danger of defeating himself with his own arguments. I said, to hear you tell it, our agricultural revolution had so little going for it that it's a wonder it happened at all.
It truly is a wonder that it happened. That's precisely what I want you to see. And when you see it, your vision of human history will be changed forever.
I'm ready for that.
I'd like to introduce you to a people who will help me in this endeavor. The Gabusi of New Guinea.
The Gabusi? Have I heard of them?
Probably not. The Gabusi are one of those agricultural peoples whose agricultural style owes nothing at all to our revolution. In fact, it would make better sense to call them hunter-gardeners than farmers. They're villagers who love to socialize, celebrate, and party with a lot of shouting, singing, and joking. Two-thirds of them die of what we would call natural causes, and one-third are murdered by friends, neighbors, or relatives. Murder is male business, and at any given time, two-thirds of the men have murdered someone.
Nice folks to know.
Oddly enough, they are, on the whole, very nice folks to know. Not saints, obviously, but pleasant, well-meaning people. If you were to ask them why they are so inclined toward violence, they literally wouldn't know what you're talking about. They aren't notably inclined toward violence. And if you wanted to interview them about crime in their society, you'd have to begin by explaining what crime is. Well, they do things that annoy each other, of course, and there are just as many greedy, boorish, inconsiderate, and selfish people among them as there are among us. But crime, as we understand it, is non-existent. Apart from homicide statistics, the main difference between them and us is their theory of sickness and death. We believe these occur when invisible creatures called microbes or germs or viruses invade our bodies and cause them to malfunction and degenerate. There's nothing in Gabusi thought that corresponds to this notion. In fact, there's nothing in their thought that corresponds to our notion of death from natural causes. For them, every sickness and death is caused supernaturally by someone who literally wishes you ill. This may be a sorcerer, or it may be the spirit of someone living or dead, or even the spirit of an animal. To diagnose an illness, a medium visits the spirit world in order to discover the guilty party, and this information indicates the best means of treatment. In a case of death, the medium conducts an inquest in consultation with the spirits. Not every inquest leads to the accusation of a living person, but when it does, the accused is given the chance to demonstrate his or her innocence by performing a sego divination.
a cooking feat so difficult that skill alone can't assure success. You might compare its difficulty to cooking a perfect souffle the size of a bathtub. Complete success is taken as a sign that the spirit of the deceased was on hand to help out, and thus exonerate the accused. Partial success leaves the matter in doubt, and the accused will probably be spared for a while as other indicators are considered, such as the behavior of the corpse in the suspect's presence. As the result of the Sago divination falls farther and farther short of success, guilt becomes clearer and clearer. In this event, since denial of the crime is pointless in the face of such evidence, the sorcerer will generally express remorse and will try to persuade everyone that the anger that moved him or her to practice this sorcery has spent itself. Everyone wants to believe it and tries to persuade the sorcerer that all is forgiven, but chances are the miscreant's days are numbered. Among the Gibusi, the spirits of the dead soon return as animals. Those who die young return as small animals, birds or lizards. Those who die at a more advanced age return as larger animals, cassowaries or crocodiles, for example. But executed sorcerers invariably return as wild pigs, which probably explains why executed sorcerers are invariably cooked and eaten. Being sorcerers, they are already, in some sense, wild pigs, which are hunted not only because they're good to eat, but because they're inhabited by malevolent spirits. I interrupted to ask if the Gibusi practice cannibalism in other circumstances. As far as I know, the only human item on their menu is roasted sorcerer. Now to the point of this anthropological exercise. I want you to imagine that it was not the people of our culture who teemed over the world and made it their own, but rather the Gibusi. I want you to imagine a world where every death is routinely avenged by killing and eating a sorcerer. I want you to imagine a world where if you were a telephone installer, legislator, or fashion designer in Berlin or Beijing or Tokyo or London or New York City or Box Elder, Montana, you might at any moment be required to perform a successful Sago divination in order to save your life. I want you to imagine a world where eating sorcerers is a perfectly normal thing to do, as normal as sending your children off to educational concentration camps when they reach the age of 5 or 6. I want you to imagine a world where killing a man will turn him into a wild pig, as surely as punishing a man will turn him into a good citizen. B paused at this point and gave me a hopeful look that I wasn't sure how to answer. I said, I think you're telling me that every culture's lunacy seems like sanity to the members of that culture. That's certainly so. If I were to tell you that the Gibusi believe that the creator of the universe has spoken to only one people on this earth during its entire history, and that one people is the Gibusi, you would smile patronizingly, wouldn't you? Yes, I suppose I would. Yet this is precisely what the people of our culture believe, isn't it? Has the creator of the universe spoken to anyone but us? No. Modern humans have been around for 200,000 years, but according to our beliefs, God had not a word to say to any of them until we came along. God didn't speak to the Alawa of Australia, or to the Gibusi of New Zealand, or to the Bushmen of Africa, or to the Navajo of North America, or to the Ihalmiut of the Great Barrens of Canada. God didn't speak a word to any of the other hundreds of thousands of peoples of the world. He spoke only to us. Only to us did he reveal the order and purpose of creation. Only to us did he reveal the laws essential to salvation. That's right. Speaking with the voice of undoubted faith. That's right. But this isn't lunacy. No, again, speaking with the voice of undoubted faith, this isn't lunacy. It would be completely silly for the Gibusi to believe that the supreme God of the universe speaks to them, but it's not at all silly for us to believe that the supreme God of the universe speaks to us. That's right. Excellent. Now I want you to do something. What do you want me to do? I want you to imagine that the world, this world right here,
is a Gabusi world. You, as a Roman Catholic priest, would be tolerated as a vestige of a quaint and harmless superstition. At night, men would cluster in bars not to watch televised sports, but to hold raunchy conversations with female spirits clinging to the rafters. Spirit mediums would be on hand to diagnose and cure minor illnesses, and to conduct inquests into community deaths. Friends would invite you to a restaurant to celebrate a killing, and send you home with a slice of roast sorcerer for your family. What more can I tell you? The films would be Gabusi films, the novels Gabusi novels, the politics Gabusi politics, the sports Gabusi sports, the fun Gabusi fun. I guess I can imagine it, more or less. But I can't imagine what you want me to say about it. How does it seem to you?
How does it seem?
It seems insane, obscene.
Of course it does.
Confined to their own few hundred square miles, the Gabusi are quaint and bizarre. Blow them up into a universal world culture to which every human must belong, and they become an obscenity. The same is true in general. Any culture will become an obscenity when blown up into a universal world culture to which all must belong. Confined to the few hundred square miles in which it was born, our own culture would have been merely quaint and bizarre. Blown up into a universal world culture to which all must belong, it is a horrifying obscenity.
I think I'm beginning to see. I think I'm beginning to see what you're getting at as a whole.
Yes. You probably don't remember why I brought up the Gabusi in the first place. You said it was a wonder that we ever adopted totalitarian agriculture, considering the fact that far from making life easier or more secure, it actually has the opposite effect.
Yes, I remember.
I wanted you to see that lifestyle strategies adopted in a culture aren't necessarily logical. They don't necessarily benefit people in obvious ways. They aren't necessarily adopted because they make life more comfortable, although people may use this rationale to explain them to children and outsiders. In our culture, for example, the adoption of our style of agriculture is presented to our children as an inevitable step forward for the human race because it makes life easier and more secure.
What does it do if it doesn't make life easier and more secure?
That's exactly what we're trying to understand here. We're presented with a complex of behaviors, and we're trying to figure out how they work together to produce the result that we see. Right now, sort through the peculiarities of the Gabusi and see if you can find a mechanism that would tend to make them blow up into a universal world culture to which all must belong.
What sort of mechanism do you mean?
Some dynamic within the culture, some custom, some deeply held belief. I spent a minute on it, but could find no mechanism that would produce that effect.
Invent one, then.
Well, I suppose territorial ambitions would have that effect. Not by themselves. The Aztecs had territorial ambitions, but once they conquered you, they didn't give a damn how you lived. They weren't interested in turning their neighbors into Aztecs. This is why, vile as they may have been, they were not us, not what Ishmael calls takers.
Okay, I see where you're coming from. You'd have to make them cultural missionaries if you wanted them to blow up into a world-dominating culture.
And in order to make them cultural missionaries, you'd have to endow them with a belief. Missionaries are nothing if not believers. What kind of believers would the Gabusi have to be?
They would have to be believers in the rightness of their way of life.
Exactly. If the Gabusi believed that theirs was the one right way for all humans to live, which they don't, by the way, this would motivate them to become cultural missionaries to the world. But the belief alone wouldn't be enough. The people of our culture have always held this belief. But they needed another mechanism as well. I suppose you could call it a spreading mechanism. A mechanism that would push them across the face of their earth as they spread the gospel of their cultural enlightenment.
Agriculture. agriculture of a particular design, Jared. Because not every kind of agriculture will push a people across the face of the earth. The modest agriculture of the Gibusi simply wouldn't support such an expansion.
I understand.
In our culture, to support one peculiarity, we needed a second peculiarity. And the two reinforced each other. We believed, and still believe, that we have the one right way for people to live. But we needed totalitarian agriculture to support our missionary effort. Totalitarian agriculture gave us fabulous food surpluses, which are the foundation of every military and economic expansion. No one was able to stand against us anywhere in the world because no one had a food-producing machine as powerful as ours. Our military and economic success confirmed our belief that we have the one right way to live. It still does so today. For the people of our culture, the fact that we're able to defeat and destroy any other lifestyle is taken as clear proof of our cultural superiority.
Yes, I'm afraid that's so.
As a boy, I remember reading a science fiction story about a mutant organism that was born in a drain in the fortuitous confluence of a dib of this and a dab of that. This organism was driven by a single tropism, which was to turn living matter into itself. Unstopped, it had the capability of reversing in a few days billions of years of biological evolution by devouring all life forms on this planet and turning them into a single form, itself. This mutant organism is a perfect metaphor for our culture, which in just a few centuries is reversing millions of years of human development by devouring all cultures on this planet and turning them into a single culture, our own.
An ugly thought.
It's an ugly process. Gunpowder is a mixture of potassium nitrate, charcoal, and sulfur, and I suppose you know that if any one of these ingredients is missing, then the mixture isn't explosive.
Of course.
As an explosive mixture, our culture also consists of three essential ingredients, and if any one of them had been missing, no explosion would have taken place here on this planet. We've already identified two of the ingredients: totalitarian agriculture and the belief that ours is the one right way. The third is, of course, the great forgetting. I thought about it some, but finally told him I couldn't see how the great forgetting had contributed to the explosion. It contributed to the explosion roughly the way that charcoal contributes to the explosion of gunpowder. How did we come to have the strange idea that our way is the one right way?
I don't know.
Let's go back again to the foundation thinkers of our culture: Herodotus, Confucius, Abraham, Anaximander, Pythagoras, Socrates, and any others you can think of. Assemble them all in one room and ask them this question: how long have people been living the way we live? What would be their answer?
Their answer would be, people have been living this way from the beginning.
In other words, man was born living this way.
That's right.
And what does this tell you about the nature of man?
It tells me that man was meant to live this way. Man is meant to live as a totalitarian agriculturalist and a city builder, the way bees were meant to live as honey collectors and hive builders.
So tell me, Jared, what else could this be except the one right way?
Yes, I see that.
So tell me, what was forgotten during the Great Forgetting?
What was forgotten was the fact that man was not born a totalitarian agriculturalist and a city builder. What was forgotten was the fact that our way was not ordained from the beginning of time. If this hadn't been forgotten, then we would never have been able to persuade ourselves that ours is the one right way.
Let's go for a walk, B said, suddenly abandoning the subject. There's something I have to pick up for you.
Something for me?
Something you'll need later.
I started to head out the way I'd come, but B beckoned me in the opposite direction, down a hall that opened up behind his chair, the same hall from which Monica and Heinz Keitel had appeared with refreshments the night before.
The hall soon widened to accommodate concrete benches on either side, and B told me it had been designed to serve as a bomb shelter for both the theater and a government office building the next street over. After a couple hundred meters, the tunnel angled up and terminated at a heavy fire door that opened into the sub-basement storage room of a government building of some kind. Surprisingly, there was a desk here and someone manning it, evidently to monitor access to the storage areas. This person, a middle-aged, soldierly type, glared at us with disapproval, but made no vocal objection to our passing through his territory. Two flights of stairs took us up to the ground floor and the street.